This is the American Association of Physics Teachers pilot podcasting series.
2009 Winter Meeting, Chicago, Illinois.
Session NA, AAP Tape Plenary, Dark Matter in the Laboratory. Joseph D. Lytton from Fermilab. Presider, David Cook.
Simplest way actually to explain conflated is what Prince Zwicky did. So he looked out at this cluster of galaxies. This is the Coma cluster. It's about 1,000 galaxies. That's what all those smudges are. And he said, well, Hubble has already measured the redshifts from galaxies, and he's seen from that that the universe is expanding. But I can also do something a little more sophisticated. I can use those same redshifts to tell me how these galaxies in this cluster are moving relative to each other. Because after all, this cluster of galaxies, presumably, is a bunch of galaxies that are mutually attracted by their gravitational attraction. They're orbiting around each other. And let me figure out what those orbital speeds are by measuring the redshifts. So that was a simple thing to do. He did it not with the kind of accuracy we have today, but he did it as good a job as he could. And then he said, well, now let me compare that to the escape velocity of these guys. They're in orbits, right? And so there's some speed at which they would all fly apart. So let me figure out what that is. So I just need Newton's law of gravity to do that. But I also need to know the mass of the clusters. But he said, well, I can do that because I can just count the galaxies. And I know pretty much how many stars there are in a galaxy. I know pretty much how much a star weighs. So I can figure out the mass of this cluster and use that to figure out the escape velocity. So he does that, and he finds out that almost all these galaxies in this cluster are moving faster than their escape velocity. So this cluster should not exist. It should have blown apart billions of years ago. And this is true of all the galaxy clusters we see. And in fact, Vera-Rubin then showed that it's actually true of galaxies. The stars in a galaxy should also not hold together. Galaxies themselves should fly apart. So there is something that is holding the universe together that is not the galaxies themselves, and which is the reason why we're here. It's the reason why the universe holds together in galaxies and stars. So that's certainly a big mystery, but it sort of kind of sat there for decades, and people didn't really know what to do with it. But in more recent times, we've gotten more sophisticated handles on this, and here's one very beautiful, sophisticated handle, which is to use the idea of gravitational lensing. And this goes to the idea of what Einstein told us, which is that when you have matter, no matter what kind of matter it is, it bends the fabric of space-time. And that means that light coming from distant sources like a galaxy, if it goes through a region where there's a lot of mass, the light will be bent. And we can actually see this when there's lots and lots of mass in the form of distortions of the shapes of distant galaxies. So if you look at this picture on the left, you'll see a lot of little bluish-white streaks. And that actually looks like I've distorted the photograph here of these distant galaxies. But I didn't distort it. Something else did. Huge quantities of invisible matter between us and these galaxies distorted that picture. So this gravitational lensing is another way of seeing that there's a huge amount of invisible matter. And you can even turn this around and, using what we know as the properties of gravitational lensing, figure out what the distribution of that invisible matter is, and that gives you a plot like the one on the right. The spikes in this plot are galaxies, so that's the visible matter. But you see that there's this big mountain, and the big mountain is the invisible matter, the dark matter, that also has to be there. Okay, well, there's lots of ways of things being invisible. So if I weren't a crazy particle theorist, I would have a much more prosaic explanation of dark matter. I would say, well, it's probably just stuff that doesn't shine like stars. So, for example, gas, you know, atoms and molecules, if they're out there in space, they have mass, but they don't necessarily shine the way that stars do. And indeed, there is gas in galaxies. Sometimes it does shine invisible light, and you see that as these beautiful nebulae that you see in the picture. But most of the time, this gas doesn't shine invisible light, and it's in galaxies. It's in between galaxies, so it's in galaxy clusters, and there's a lot of it. A lot of space up there. And it was only recently that we were able to see this gas and actually pin down how much of it there is. And the reason we can see it is that although it's not emitting visible light most of the time, it is emitting X-rays. And with Chandra, which was an X-ray detecting satellite, we're able to look at something like the Coma cluster and see that in fact it is shining in X-rays from gas. Ordinary is mostly this ionized hydrogen gas. So there is a lot of gas there, which we weren't able to see before. Now we can see it. And we can figure out how much there is, basically from the brightness and how big these gas clouds are. And in fact, there is more gas than there is stars and planets. So that's part of the mystery solved. Part of what we were missing there was, in fact, gas that we now see using X-rays. So maybe that's the whole problem, then I can sit in my coffee. But in order to see that it's not the answer. We have to solve a homework problem. So I'm now going to, since there are many teachers in this audience, I'm going to finally get my revenge on you. My son, who's a junior in high school, is taking physics. He gets these WebAssign homework problems. Furthermore, all his friends know that his father is a physicist, so they call up and they want help with their homework. So this has been my year of WebAssign physics homework problems. So I'm going to make you do actually two problems in this talk. And here's problem number one. Given what I just told you, that there's gas in the Homa Galaxy cluster, and that Chandra saw X-rays coming from it, as you saw in that picture. And I'll give you one other piece of information, which is that the size of that gas cloud I showed you is, has a radius of about 1 megaparsec. Now, do a better estimate than what Tweaky did of the total mass of this galaxy cluster, including any invisible matter, dark matter that's there. So at first, it may seem like this is a hard problem in the fact that you don't have enough information to solve it. But you can solve this problem, and it only requires what I would call simple high school physics. So let's go through it. So the first thing I need to know is that in a cluster like this, where you have a bunch of, after all, this gas consists of ionized hydrogen, which is a proton, so it's just particles of ordinary matter, and they've been running around for billions of years in this cluster. When things have been running around for billions of years, interacting through gravity, there's a relation between their kinetic energy and their potential energy. And in fact, there's a fancy theorem called the Virial theorem that tells you what that relation is, that the kinetic energy ends up on the average being minus a half the potential energy. But you didn't even need to know the Virial theorem. This is a sort of common sense. You take a system like this of a bunch of atoms or molecules or planets or whatever they are, and you let them rotate around each other for a long time, you get some kind of a balance between their gravitational potential energy and their kinetic energy. So that's one thing you need to know. Then you need to know what the kinetic energy is. But I told you that when I said that this gas emits X-rays. At least I gave you a way to estimate it. Because if this gas is emitting X-rays, that energy has to come from somewhere. It's coming from the kinetic energy, from the fact that these guys are hot. This is a gas of hot protons. So if there emits an X-ray photon whose energy is, here I've done it in units of kiloelectron volts, they must not have, each individual proton must not have more kinetic energy than 10 kiloelectron volts. So I can get at least an estimate of what the kinetic energy is of all these protons running around in this galaxy cluster from the fact that they're able to emit X-ray photons. And then I have to convert this into joules because I'm always supposed to do these things in MCS. Okay, then I need to know Newton's gravitational law, and I know everything in that formula except for the mass of the cluster. I know the mass of the proton, I know Newton's constant, and I told you that the size of this is about 1 megaparsec. So I'm just sort of, I'm ignoring the fact that these gas protons have different locations. I'm just averaging it out to 1 megaparsec. And you need to know that a megaparsec is 3 × 10⁻²⁰ meters. Okay. So now I can figure out what the mass of the galaxy cluster is. And this is the whole mass. It's the mass of everything that produces gravity. So that should include all the dark matter, no matter what it is. Right? Because Einstein told us that everything produces gravity, whether it likes it or not. So now I get the answer, so you can do this, and the answer to your homework problem is the actual mass of this cluster of galaxies, including the dark matter, is 10 to the 45 kilograms, which a more reasonable unit is in terms of the mass of the sun. It's 500 trillion times the mass of the sun. So this is a very interesting result because this is about 5 times the mass of all the galaxies and the gas. So I told you that there was all this invisible gas, but the invisible gas is not all the invisible stuff. In fact, it's a small fraction of the invisible stuff. Almost all the stuff in this galaxy cluster is some other kind of thing, that's what I call dark matter, that is gravitating and is holding this cluster together, but it is not ordinary material. Okay. And here's a fancy picture which you may have seen. It's a fake picture like many of the pictures that you see. Particles. It's a composite of a Chandra X-ray. This pink stuff is X-rays coming from gas. And what this is a picture of is it's called the Bullet Galaxy Cluster, but as you can see, it's not a galaxy cluster. It's two galaxy clusters that collided. And they've actually already collided a long time ago, and they've gone through each other and now are moving apart. And so So when Chandra looked at this, it sees the two balls of gas, those two red splotches, which are not only emitting X-rays, but they actually, of course, they got heated up when they went through each other. They made a shockwave, and they actually got much hotter, so they're emitting more X-rays and hotter X-rays because of the fact that they collided. And then the other tricky thing that was done here was the Hubble Space Telescope is able to see these gravitational lensing effects. And from that, it was able to figure out, using gravitational lensing, where the dark matter is in these clusters. And that's the blue. So the blue is something that the computer has figured out from this data, where the dark matter is, and made these blue splotches. And this is very interesting because it tells you, first of all, that the dark matter, when these galaxy clusters collided, the dark matter just went right through each other, just like the stars and galaxies mostly did. The gas didn't do that, because even though the gas is very thin, it's two bags of hot gas to try and make them move through each other. They'll find out that each other is there, and they'll eat each other up. So this is really, I think, the most conclusive visual way of seeing that the dark matter is not ordinary matter. The ordinary matter is the red gas. The ordinary red gas is doing what you would expect it to do. The dark matter, whatever it is doing what you would not expect it to do. It just passes through each other like light didn't even know anything. So I've already, I hope, convinced you of the first couple of points here, that what we're talking about with dark matter is not gas. It's not something like you counted the number of stars along, that some of them were too dim. It's not mostly planets. There are a lot of planets out there that we're now discovering, but it's not really enough to talk about this. One not so obvious point is that it's not mostly neutrinos. And to this, I'll show you why we think that's true. But you would have thought that neutrinos is a very good idea to explain dark matter, because neutrinos are an elementary particle that we know about. They exist. We studied them in Fermilab. They are invisible for the most part. They're very, very hard to detect. They hardly interact at all with ordinary matter. And there's lots and lots of them out there. So they're hard to detect. There's lots and lots of them out there. That sounds like a good candidate for dark matter. And in fact, they are part of the dark matter. They're a few percent of the dark matter. But they're not most of it. Another thing you might have thought of, and in fact, I've got this question a lot, it's a very good question, is, well, maybe most of the dark matter is black holes. Because after all, we learn about black holes, we learn that the reason they call them black holes is that they're invisible. They don't emit anything. And black holes, we now think, do exist. There may be lots of them out there, so maybe that's the dark matter. This is not ruled out, but I think there's good arguments that most of the dark matter is probably not black holes. And one of the reasons for that is the reason we've convinced ourselves that black holes exist is because stuff tends to fall into black holes. They have very strong gravitational forces. And when the stuff falls into black holes, the stuff emits light, things like X-rays. And that's the reason why we think, for example, that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of our own galaxy. It's not just that we've seen it, because we can't see it, but there's a whole bunch of stuff falling into something in the center of our galaxy, and we think that something is a supermassive black hole. So that's, it's not completely ruled out that black holes could be most of the dark matter, but we think it's probably. Well, if you buy all of that, what's left is some completely new kind of matter. So even more exotic than neutrinos, which is already a pretty exotic idea, would have to be the explanation. So let me explain why we think neutrinos are not most of the dark matter. Cosmologists, astrophysicists that talk about dark matter, they like to talk about cold dark matter and hot dark matter. This is a very strange terminology. When they say hot dark matter, what they actually mean is dark matter particles that are traveling close to the speed of light. So it's not what you would normally think of as hot. And when they say cold dark matter, they mean dark matter particles that are not traveling close to the speed of light. So that's what this really means. And although we don't have our hands in dark matter yet, you can make simulations of what dark matter would look like, how it would be distributed out there in the universe, by making certain assumptions about what the properties of the dark matter are. Like, is it hot or is it cold? And here's an example of what you get when you do these kinds of simulations. So these are in false colors to remind you that this is not supposed to be stars and galaxies. It's supposed to be the dark matter, how it would be distributed, and the galaxies would then tend to cluster around where the dark matter was. So it's not the galaxies themselves, but it's, if you like, the seeds of where galaxies and galaxy clusters should be. And then the only thing you have to ask yourself is whether the picture on the left or the picture on the right looks more like the universe we do see in terms of visible galaxies. And the answer, obviously, is the picture on the left. The picture on the left has the complicated structure that we see when we look out at galaxy clusters in the real universe. So we think, because of this, that the dark matter is what we call cold, meaning that the particles are moving, whatever they are moving fairly slowly. Neutrinos don't do this. Neutrinos, in addition to being very elusive and strange particles, they have very tiny masses, and they move very close to the speed of light, even the ones that are out there in the cold universe. And so, because of that, we think that they can't be most of the dark matter. And there's other data that we have now that pins this down quite precisely. So the simulation idea is now becoming a very powerful idea, partly because we have very big computers and we can do simulations sort of of what the whole universe would look like, what its whole structure might be, given certain assumptions. So here's another example of a clue. This might not be right, but it's a clue as to something about dark matter. You could ask, well, suppose there is dark matter, how much does the dark matter interact with itself? Ordinary matter interacts with itself, right? That's what I'm doing right now. I order ordinary matter and I interact with you. Dark matter presumably interacts with itself through forces other than gravity. We don't know that, but let's assume that it does. Then I could do a computer simulation and say, what does the universe look like if I assume dark matter that interacts with itself with some force, some new forces that have some kind of strength? And that affects how the universe looks, because it, depending on what those forces are, the dark matter will clump together in different ways. And then you just have to ask yourself whether, for example, the picture on the left, again, looks more like the universe we have than the picture on the right. And here, again, the problem is that the picture on the right, which assumes dark matter that interacts a lot with itself, is sort of too smooth. It's too, the splotches in the middle are sort of too round. It's too regular. We don't see regular forms like that when you look out at the distribution of galaxies. They're all over the place in very complicated patterns. So this is a hint that the dark matter, whatever it is, it not only doesn't interact very much with us, it doesn't interact very much with itself. So this has led to what you might call the triumph of the wimp, which is the name that Michael Turner, who is a famous cosmologist and is at this meeting, the term that he used to describe a particular set of assumptions for what dark matter is, which I've just made motivated for you, that dark matter is some kind of new particle, of course there could be several kinds of particles, and that these particles are heavy. That gets back to this, the fact that they're cold, that they're not zipping around at the speed of light, almost the speed of light that neutrinos do, and that they interact, we know this for sure, they interact very weakly with ordinary matter, but perhaps also very weakly with their own kind. So this kind of dark matter is known as WIMPs, for weakly interacting massive particles. So for the rest of this talk, I'm going to assume that the dark matter that we're looking for is WIMPs. So if that's wrong, then all the experiments that I'm going to talk to you about are going to fail, because they are designed to look for dark matter that is not only new particles, but are weakly interacting massive particles with more or less. So this is a problem in science. When you have a big mystery like this, where you don't know what you're doing, you can go down completely the wrong road and be in trouble. There are people that are designing other kinds and operating other kinds of experiments that will look at other assumptions about dark matter. So it's not that we aren't covering all the bases. But most of the experiments that are going on now, including all the ones I'll talk about, are looking for WIMPs. WIMPs rule the universe. So here's method number one. If there are all these WIMPs out there, dark matter filling up the universe, five times as much dark matter as ordinary matter, it must be raining down on us. There are particles of dark matter all over the place in our galaxy, holding the galaxy together. So they must be striking the Earth all the time. And you can figure out how much, how often they're striking the Earth, because we know how much dark matter there is, and you can just assume that it's evenly distributed, which it isn't, but just to get a rough idea, you can assume that. Then you can figure out how many dark matter particles are passing through your body right now. So right now there are about 200 dark matter particles in your body, if they're WIMP-like dark matter particles. They're moving at about 400,000 miles an hour. And that sounds a little alarming at first glance, but the good thing is that dark matter interacts very weakly. So maybe once a day, once a week, we don't actually know. that's not too alarming because ordinary cosmic rays, which have nothing to do with dark matter, are also doing that. It's something that we just can't get away from. So dark matter is presumably coming in from space. It's going through everything. And now we just have to figure out, can we make it a sufficiently sensitive detector to see those dark matter particles, to occasionally find one of them and make a blip somewhere. So that sounds like a simple idea. And here's a complicated looking slide that is also fleshing this out, and it's actually very simple what's going on here. So first of all, there's a whole bunch of weird names on this slide. Each of these is a name, most of them are acronyms, for a dark matter detection experiment that's going on someplace. So for example, CDMS, which is on the upper right there, which is the cryogenic dark matter search, is a dark matter search that's going on. I'll show you a picture of it in Minnesota with a lot of involvement from Fermilab, my laboratory. So it's one of the experiments that we're most excited about. But as you see, there are many of them because they're all competing with each other. Everybody wants to be the first experiment to see, to really discover in a way that no one can deny the existence of these dark matter particles and start to figure out their properties. So it is a huge scientific competition all around the world, all these different experiments. But the other thing I want you to see from this complicated slide is that these experiments are all making use of one or more of three techniques to detect dark matter. When a dark matter particle does interact with a piece of material, there's basically three things that it can do. It can deposit some heat in the material. It can make an electrical pulse in the material, or it can make a little flash of light in the material. And that's what these fancy words here in this triangle are saying. The ionization means it makes an electrical pulse. The, phonon, that just means it deposits some heat, light, and the scintillation means it makes a flash of light. So all of these experiments are using one of those techniques to try and look for dark matter. The really clever experiments are using two of these techniques simultaneously. So for example, CDMS looks for both the deposition of a light pulse and an electrical pulse at the same time. Using two different methods at once, as you might imagine, gives you a much better handle. What it is you're looking for. After all, I want to make sure that I don't just see a blip. I want to make sure that that blip is dark matter and not something else. We don't know yet which of these experiments is the best, which technique is the best, and which one is going to make the discovery. And so it's good that all these people are competing, because if we had to do these sort of one at a time, it might take us 100 years to figure out the right way to do it. So let me go back to CDMS. I said this is the one that we're involved in at Fermilab. We're not doing it at Fermilab, and the reason we're not doing it at Fermilab is if you take a detector like that and you put it on this table and you turn it on, you'll see lots of blips, all right, but they're coming from natural radiation and from cosmic rays. So that's completely hopeless. So unfortunately for us, you have to go do these things down a mine somewhere. And in this case, it's being done in the Sudan mine, which is an iron mine in northern Minnesota. Place that always looks like this. It's a broken leaf. I grew up in Minnesota, so I can vouch for the fact that it's a broken leaf. It is much warmer when you go down about 2,000 feet, so maybe that's a good thing. And here's part of the collaboration, actually. I think this is down in the mine. Very hard at. So you go down to 2,000 feet in the mine. That gets away from most of the cosmic rays, which is one of the things that will make a false blip in your detector. You then have to construct these very sensitive detectors. So what you're seeing here on the upper right is part of the CDMS detector. So one thing you notice is that it's not very large. We would like it to be larger, but these detectors are very sensitive. It's very difficult to put together these very sensitive detectors. We only have so much money to do it. And so we build them as big as we can, but with the limited budget, we're still talking about reasonably small detectors. But as I said, you know, there's lots of dark matter particles going through your body, going through this even reasonably small detector. So it doesn't mean you won't see a signal from a small detector. The other thing you have to do with this detector is you have to cool it down. CDMS runs at about 1/100th of a degree above absolute zero. So that sounds hard, but nowadays it's actually, well, I call it a piece of cake. I wouldn't actually know how to do it, but for people that know how to do it, it's a piece of cake. So you go down 2,000 feet in the mine, you build this incredibly sensitive detector, you cool it down to 100 degree above absolute zero, and then you let it sit for 6 months, and then you see what kinds of blips you get. Now, even though we've done all of these amazing things to try and prevent this experiment from seeing noise or seeing things that aren't dark matter, there's really no way around the fact that most of the things that you will see, most of the blips in these very sensitive detectors, are not dark matter. And you actually know some of the reasons for this. It doesn't matter how far I go down to the mine, the rock in the mine is radioactive at some level. So you can't get away from that radiation. In fact, the material in the detector or in the thing that holds the detector is slightly radioactive. Your body is radioactive. Everything's radioactive at some level. There's also radiation in the air. There's radon gas. It's the same thing that leaks into your basement and kills you. You can't get rid of all this natural radiation. And the cosmic rays, although you can get rid of most of them down the mine, there's lots of cosmic rays. Some of them are very high energy particles. Nature has a very large budget for particle accelerators. So you can't get away from that stuff. But as I said, the CDMS detector, in addition to being very sensitive, it detects dark matter blips in two different ways. And because of that, and also using fancy things like very precise timing, they're able to tell the difference in a very convincing way between this kind of what we call background radiation and the thing they're actually looking for, which are these significant dark matter particles. So at the end of the day, what they will show, and this is not just the latest results, I think these are results that I'm not supposed to show, so they're preliminary sensitivity projections for this experiment. And the way they make these plots is they say, okay, let's look for some blips that would be dark matter, eliminate all the things that look like they're ordinary radiation, and then, do we have anything left over that could be dark matter? If you don't have anything that looks like a dark matter blip, then what we do is you set what we call limits. So you say, okay, so now I know that the dark matter doesn't have certain properties. And what do I know? Well, you have to do this as a function of two things. Because how many blips you would see would depend on what the mass is of dark matter particles. And it also depends on how much the dark matter particles interact with ordinary matter. And we don't know either one of those things. So when I don't see something, I can then say, well, if they interacted at least this much with ordinary matter, and if their mass was in a certain range, then I would have seen them. And since I didn't see them, I can rule all that out. And so in these curves here, everything above the curve means that the dark matter particles, if they interacted at least that much, we would have already seen them, and therefore they don't do that. They must interact even more deeply than what's shown on this plot. So as these curves go down and down and down, what you're doing is you're looking at more and more weakly interacting possibilities for dark matter. As we'll see at the end of this talk, theories that predict what the dark matter particles are, like supersymmetry, tell you sort of what are the interesting parts of this plot. And the only thing I want you to really take away from this plot is that these CDMS sensitivity curves, so far they haven't seen a signal, so these are just ruling out things that could have been there. They're ruling out a whole bunch of that shaded region, that shaded round region, which is where we theorists told them they ought to start seeing dark matter particles if they are produced by a theory like supersymmetry. So we're not just ruling out any old dark matter particles. We think we are now getting to the sensitivity where we should see dark matter particles of the type that seems sort of most natural from a theoretical point of view to be there. And of course, that may mean that we'll have discovery. We have discovery this year. They're running this experiment right now. You may wake up 3 months from now, and there'll be an article in the paper saying dark matter has been discovered by CDMS. Okay, so now I want to move on to the other, even more ambitious method of finding dark matter, which is to manufacture it from scratch. So sure, there's plenty of there out in the universe, but I don't need that. I can make my own in my lab. So here, my lab is Fermi Labs, which has what is currently the world's highest energy particle collider. Particle colliders are a way of manufacturing both ordinary matter and new kinds of matter. And I hope all of you have been out to Fermi Labs. You should make the trip. And the way you manufacture new kinds of matter is you go talk to this guy, and he tells you that energy is convertible into matter. And therefore, if you have lots of energy, which you can get by accelerating ordinary particles, at Fermi Lab, we use protons and antiprotons, accelerate them so they have lots of kinetic energy, smash them together, that energy can be converted to new kinds of particles that don't normally exist on the Earth, like dark matter. In fact, we must produce those particles if the laws of physics allow this to happen, if you have enough energy, if you keep making things together long enough, you will produce all of these exotic particles allowed by nature, including dark matter. So we're doing this at Fermilab. There is another laboratory called CERN, which is on in Geneva, the French-Swiss border. They also have a particle accelerator, which is not quite working yet, but will be working, we hope, later this year. And it blows us out of the water at Fermilab at almost 10 times the energy that we have at the Fermilab Pevatron. As you can see, well, this is a good picture of the face, like many of the pictures I'm showing you. That round ring there is drawn because the actual accelerator is underground, but it is 27 kilometers around. This is compared to the Geneva Airport, sort of get an idea of the size. It's an absolutely immense undertaking, but it is now done, and they're just getting a few bugs out of it, and it's going to be running into this year. So that's a lot of energy. You can imagine that you wouldn't bother to build a 27 kilometer accelerator unless you were getting a lot of energy out of it. It is, in fact, right in the energy regime where you should be able to make the kind of dark matter particles that we estimate from this set of wind arguments I was making, the dark matter should be. So we're very excited that either the Tevatron might get lucky in the next few years when it's running, but certainly the LHC should have plenty of energy to make these dark matter particles. Now, as I said, the real experiment is underground, and not enough to have a huge accelerator after you smash the protons, the LHC and protons, after you smash them together, you then have to figure out what happened. And so for that, we have experiments. And the two relevant experiments in the dark matter search are called TMS and ATLAS, so the opposite ends, more or less, of this 27-kilometer ring. They're underground. They're absolutely huge things. There was a session yesterday, which some of you might have attended, where the spokespeople of these experiments showed all the amazing technology that went into these detectors. They're $500 million each of electronics to figure out what happens in these very high energy collisions. And as I'm going to show you, we're going to need all that information to figure out whether we made dark matter. The one other point I wanted to make here is that although this is the largest science project anyone has ever attempted, it is not the first time that there's been a huge construction project on this site. So this was built between Lake Geneva and the Jura Mountains here in the Rhone Valley. As it turns out, in 58 BC, Julius Caesar built a wall between that lake and those set of mountains, which, unlike this project, which took 15 years, he did it in about 6 months. And the reason he did it was because in those days, the Swiss were a warlike people, and they were threatening to invade the Rhone Valley, which was an ally of Rome. And so to keep them out until he could get reinforcements, he had his poor legionnaires and I guess whoever else he could rope into it, build a wall all the way across this valley. And that was a good thing, in fact, for this area because it led to a permanent Roman settlement there, which we then rediscovered when we were digging the holes for these experiments. When they were digging the holes for the TMS experiment, they actually found the coins that are shown in the lower left and lower right there from the ancient Roman days. So, you know, some things never change. This is what it looks like underground. You're seeing here one of the bending magnets that keeps the protons going around in the LHC. You also see our fire department, which has the world's skinniest fire trucks so that they can drive around this 27-kilometer road to get around the ring in case anything bad happens. We did actually have a bad thing that happened last September when these magnets, in order to bend, you might imagine that when you have the world's highest energy protons and you're trying to bend them around a ring, that you need a really powerful magnet. You need thousands of really powerful magnets. And the reason those magnets are really powerful, they're electromagnets, is they have a lot of current flowing through them. The connection between these magnets have about 10,000 amps of current. Somebody had to actually solder those connections. There's 10,000 of them. 9,999 of those connections were right on perfect. One of them was not. But that's the kind of thing, if you try an experiment at this scale, things like that will happen to you and fix them. And that's why, you know, experiments take years. You don't just turn this thing on and have it work right. detectors, the Eccles detectors, the one in the middle, the CMS detector, slice, actually just a small slice of the CMS detector, the cover of Newsweek. Just to give you an idea of the size, an Atlas detector is the world's largest particle detector. It weighs about 7,000 tons. CMS is slightly smaller, but it's also denser, and it weighs about 12,000 tons. And I've given you some other items that have similar weights. So these are absolutely huge things. And the reason they're huge is because these are not only very high-energy collisions, so you need a big detector to contain everything that comes out, but they're also very complicated collisions. What comes out, you expect hundreds and hundreds of particles to come out in the collisions we're interested in. And we need to figure out what all of them were, what they were all doing, and reconstruct the entire collision to figure out what we made. So here's an explanation I got from The Onion on how all of these detectors work. That's pretty accurate. It does light up. It does have sounds of thunder. The only thing that wasn't true is that it doesn't have moving parts. But everything else is pretty much right. Another thing you may have heard about this experiment is, if you've read the book Angels and Demons, the first part of that book takes place at CERN, where he explains that the Atlas experiment somehow manufactures antimatter, which it does not. It does not manufacture anything. It detects things. And if you read that book, you'll probably want to see the movie, which is coming out in May, starring these people, starring Tom Hanks and this, she's a French actress, and Ron Howard, also known as Opie, is the director of this movie. They were just at CERN last week to see what the laboratory really looks like. It is absolutely nothing like what the environment it was. But they claimed to be very impressed, and of course they asked where the antimatter was, and had to be told that it's not like this. Although we do make antimatter. In fact, we make a lot more antimatter in Fermilab than they do at CERN. Fermilab is in fact the world's largest manufacturer of antimatter. And that leads me to my second homework problem, which is how much and how long would it take Fermilab to produce that much energy? This is an easier problem than the first one. I don't even need to give an answer. I'll give you an answer. You need to know this is just units, a kiloton. I assume a kiloton of TNT is enough to blow up the Vatican. It's probably more than enough. That's 4.2 times 10 to 12 joules. Equals mc squared, but I get the matter for free, and matter and antimatter destroy each other, so for every ounce of antimatter, I get 2 mc squared altogether. And the answer, if you just know what speed of light is that 1 kiloton of TNT is the equivalent of having 0.1 grams of antimatter, which is not much, but it takes you a long time to produce this, because although we are the world's leading manufacturer of proton pump, this is a funding-dependent estimate. A stimulus bill, who knows? All right, so I told you what we're not doing in these experiments. What are we actually doing? It's very complicated, so I just want to give you a close with the flavor of this. This is a simulation of the Atlas detector, what a collision looks like in the Atlas detector. The beams are going into the screen, so protons going into the screen, coming out of the screen, colliding in the middle of that big circle there. And then as you see, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Each one of these red or yellow stripes are high-energy particles that were produced from the collision and are coming out transverse, orthogonal to the beam. They're coming out in another direction. So the detector is supposed to figure out what all of those other high-energy particles were, figure out their energy, their momentum, and to some extent, what kind of particles they were. Were they electrons? Were they quarks? Were they photons? And that's what these complicated detectors are designed to do. In the case of dark matter is not going to be any one of these red-yellow streaks, because the dark matter, as I said, interacts very weakly with ordinary matter. So even if you make it, you're not going to see it in these detectors. The $500 million we spend on these detectors is not enough to see dark matter directly. So we're actually going to find dark matter not by pointing to a track and saying, there it is. We're going to find it by seeing that there's something missing. This is what we call missing energy search. Missing energy, it's a little confusing, because it's really more of a missing momentum search. We're just looking for an imbalance in these kinds of collisions. And balance. You see, there ought to be as much momentum going out in these directions, orthogonal to the beam, so that it all balances. The beams didn't have any transverse momentum. If I add up all that momentum from all these things coming out, it should add up to zero. I take the vector sum. And you can't really tell without measuring all these particles individually what's going on here. But what we expect is to have some events where there's a big imbalance, where there's, say, a whole bunch of stuff coming out, let's say, to the left, and nothing balancing it coming out to the right. So that's a very spectacular signature. It's something we know how to look for. It's something we have looked for. The only problem with it is that just because you see something missing doesn't mean that it's dark matter. And the really tricky part here is how you convince yourself that the missing thing is dark matter rather than a couple of other things. So, for example, as I said, neutrinos are very hard to detect. And we produce neutrinos in these collisions all the time. So neutrinos will produce missing energy, and you have to figure out how to tell the difference between neutrinos and dark matter. The other thing is that whenever you screw up in the experiments, you produce missing energy. If your whole detector wasn't turned on or wasn't functioning right, or you mismeasured something, that's missing energy. So it's a very complex process to figure this all out. Fortunately, we have a lot of experience. So we're doing this with the LHC, but we've been doing it now for more than 10 years at the Tevatron. And we have shown that we can understand missing energy and understand we haven't seen any dark matter yet at the Tevatron, but we can show that we understand the missing energy that we see, and that it's coming from neutrinos and problems with measuring things in the detector. I showed you this picture because, in fact, not only have we done this at the Tevatron, but at least two high school students that I know of actually worked with real data from the Tevatron looking for dark matter particles in the form of supersymmetric particles. They didn't discover dark matter, but they actually, by using real data, were able to say that a certain kind of supersymmetry model was ruled out. You didn't see this at the Tevatron, so it wasn't the right explanation for dark matter. So this is a game that even high school students can play with a little help, and of course, they have to be really smart. With the LHC experiment at CERN. These are not high school students, although to someone of my age, they look like high school students. These are actual PhD physicists. These are the people that are going to analyze the data at the LHC experiment, at least one of the experiments, CMS, to find dark matter in whatever form it has. So it's important to realize that these experiments are actually done by young people. The old people are doing sort of management positions and giving advice. But the real work of analyzing the data and figuring out the computer simulations that we're going to compare to the data is being done right now, and it's being done by a whole bunch of really smart, dedicated young people. These people are from all over the world. Some of these people are Italian, Turkey, one American from Caltech, Brazil. So it's smart young people from all over the world that are actually going to make this discovery. All right, and what they're doing is really complicated. Since we don't have the data yet, but they're running our simulations, and that's very important because the simulations are going to tell us what it is we're looking for, and once we see some data, it's going to tell us what kind of things we're looking at. So that gets me to the last couple slides, which is what do we hope to learn from dark matter? Well, one of the things we want to learn is why is there dark matter, and why is it stable? It's very unusual for matter to be stable. And in fact, the matter we know about is all stable because there's some kind of conserved charge that it has, and so they can't turn into something else without violating some conservation law. The simplest example of that is the electron. The electron is stable because it's the lightest particle that has an electric charge. So it doesn't decay because that would violate the conservation law of nature. So presumably that's true of dark matter, but we don't know what the conservation law is. Dark matter presumably carries some kind of new charge, some new conservation law of the laws of physics that we have no idea what it is. And that's the reason why it's stable. This explains, for example, why particles that we know about aren't the dark matter. The Z boson, for example, is a weakly interacting massive particle. It was discovered in particle accelerators in the 1980s. It's heavy, and so it has all the properties to be a dark matter particle, but it's not stable. It decays through the ordinary forces of nature in about 0.3 octoseconds. So it's very weird to have heavy particles that are stable like this. And the only way it can be is that there's some kind of new laws of nature that make these things stable. So we want to know what that is. We also want to know how dark matter is related to ordinary matter how many kinds of dark matter there are. So here's an example. I've mentioned supersymmetry a couple of times. This is maybe not the answer, but it's one of the possibilities for why dark matter is there. Supersymmetry is an idea, goes back to very basic ideas about how quantum mechanics works. But the net result of this is that in supersymmetry, you predict that there's all the particles that we know about, elementary particles, which are shown on the left, have supersymmetric partners. There are other particles heavier than them, which are their partners under this new principle of nature called supersymmetry. And in fact, one of the exciting things about this dark matter surge is that several of these supersymmetric particles have the right properties to be the dark matter that we're looking for. The supersymmetric partner of the photon, of the Z boson, and of the Higgs boson, or even mixtures of those things, if you get all mixed up, have the right properties to be dark matter. So that may be what we're actually going to find, and then that would be great, because then we're not just finding dark matter, but we're finding out how it's related to ordinary matter through supersymmetry. And also that there's a whole bunch of other unstable new particles that we can go look for at the same time. The other thing we'd like to find out once we have dark matter in the laboratory is what it tells us about the Big Bang. The dark matter was produced somehow. It may have been produced early in the Big Bang just by the fact that the Big Bang was hot. We call that thermal production. The Big Bang is very hot. It produced lots of particles, perhaps including the dark matter. Or it could be that the dark matter came from the decay of some other even more exotic objects in the early universe. So we'd like to figure that out. But more importantly, presumably the origin of dark matter happened very early in the universe because the dark matter particles are heavy things. It's hard to produce them once the universe cools off too much. So dark matter, once we have our hands on it in laboratory experiments, is going to be a window back to earlier parts of the Big Bang than we've been able to look at before by any other kinds of means. So it's not just the dark matter that's interesting. The dark matter itself is telling us about the earliest moments of the Big Bang. Okay, and then I want to close with the idea that there may be big surprises here. We're talking about stuff that we haven't seen. Everything I told you could be wrong. And there could be some big surprises. I tend to favor the supersymmetry explanation of dark matter. But other people have made perfectly good explanations of dark matter that involve extra dimensions of space. So maybe what real dark matter is really telling us is that there's extra dimensions of space. We won't know until we get our hands on it. I think there's going to be surprises, but what I began with and what I'll close with is those surprises are going to happen pretty soon. We could have a discovery of dark matter as early as this year from something like CMS. The LHC could see dark matter evidence in the next 2 years, let's say, 2-3 years. And I think that the story will then start to unravel, start to come together, not unravel, will come together very rapidly. And within 10 years from now, we'll actually be able to tell you not just a fantasy story, the real story of what dark matter is, why it's there, where it came from. And who knows what we'll see. Thank the gas. So that means the around with the supersymmetry explanation since about 1983. And we thought in 1983 that this was very exciting because we thought that the new accelerator at CERN, and not the LHC, was going to settle this issue. So you're right. So it's not just that we could be wrong about the theory. It could be that it's way hard. This problem may be way harder than what I just said.
Copyright 2009. American Association of Physics Teachers. All rights reserved.